We can just begin the interview. And
so hey, is this live or to live no, to tape or whatever you call it?
No, it's not live. It's pre-recorded, so we'll be able to edit it and so on and so forth. And you know, we're going to target for about 30 minutes.
Okay.
More or less. So, you know,
when do you think you'll play it?
That's a great question. Oh, okay. So within the next week, it sounds like.
Oh, okay.
So it'll be pretty current, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And you know, so please, you know, be as expansive as you want in answering questions, and just let it ride.
All right.
So, all right. I'll just start with an introduction here. Michael Clare is the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He's written widely on U.S. defense policy, the arms trade, and world security affairs, and is the author of many books, including Resource Wars, Blood and Oil, and most recently, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. Recent articles include Oil 2009, Be Careful What You Wish For, which can be found at tomdispatch.com, and Time to Kill the Oil Beast, America's Over-Reliance on Petroleum, is the source of all its energy problems, which is included in Newsweek's Issues 2009. Michael Clare, welcome to KBOO.
I'm very happy to be with you.
So before we drill down into your recent articles, perhaps you could describe the oil landscape for us. We've been told that the United States is addicted to oil, and as a nation, how much oil do we consume?
Well, the United States, of course, is the world's leading oil consumer. We use about one-fourth of the world's petroleum on a daily basis. That's about 21 million barrels a day out of global consumption of about 84, 85 million barrels per day.
And how about other energy sources, nuclear, hydropower, renewables? Where do those fit in the landscape?
Again, oil is our leading source of energy in this country. Oil supplies about 40% of our total energy supply. So the United States relies on oil more than any other major economy. Most other countries rely on other sources of energy, coal or nuclear power in the case of France, or natural gas. But we in this country rely on oil for our energy supply predominantly, as I say, 40%. Next comes coal, which is about 23-24%, and natural gas, which is about the same percentage. Much lower down is nuclear power, about 5 or 6%, and the same for hydropower and renewables. So our economy, our whole economy, is heavily dependent on oil.
Who are the leading exporters and importers of oil at this point?
The leading exporters of oil are Saudi Arabia and Russia, and then come a second group of exporters, which include Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, Nigeria and Africa, Mexico and Venezuela. Those are among the leading exporters, but the number one and two are Saudi Arabia and Russia.
And oil certainly touches our lives in many ways, and we know all about heating oil and, you know, transportation, gas and diesel, lubricating oil, and so on. What are the other ways that oil touches our lives, perhaps some less obvious ways?
Well, I don't think you mentioned agriculture, and of course Oregon and Washington State nearby are both major agricultural states, and in this country we rely on oil excessively, some would say, for agricultural production, both for the mechanization of agriculture, for farm equipment, but also for all kinds of agricultural inputs, for fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, and a whole variety of other products go into agriculture. Some would say that American agriculture is largely a byproduct of petroleum.
So oil really permeates our entire civilization in really important ways.
In so many ways. And in many ways, you could say the American way of life as we know it, at least since World War II, is a product of two things, oil and the internal combustion engine. The very landscape of America has been totally transformed by those two things. And I'm old enough, I drove across the United States for the first time in 1970 as a young man, driving from New York City to Berkeley, California, as so many people did in those days. And most of that drive on the then new interstate highways was across farmland. And if you made the same drive today, mostly what you would see is suburban sprawl. And that's a product, as I say, of cheap oil and the internal combustion engine.
In your new article on TomDispatch.com, which is titled Oil 2009, Be Careful What You Wish For, you provide us with three provisional observations on oil's fate, all of which are related to its price. Now, in the last year, the price of oil has varied dramatically, ranging from a high of about $150 a barrel to a low of about $33 a barrel. And currently, oil is back up to around roughly $40 a barrel. It's gone up a bit. And still, this seems like good news to consumers. I'm very happy to pay less than $2 a gallon for gasoline. What's causing this extreme price volatility, and why has the price of oil dropped through the floor?
Good questions. Well, of course, the rise in the price of oil, which we saw last spring and summer, was the product of the same forces that led to the economic bust we've seen, which was, a huge speculative bubble in real estate, but the same economic forces were driving consumption around the world, huge investment around the world, and we saw that not only in the United States, but everywhere, in China and India, in Europe, in Latin America, in the Middle East, everybody was spending, and a lot of that was for automobiles and for new transportation infrastructure. So you had not only Americans seeking more oil to fill their SUVs and other fuel-inefficient vehicles, but you had China emerging as the world's largest automobile market, and India following swiftly on its heels. So you had the most intense competition ever seen before for what's essentially becoming a dwindling supply of petroleum. And that's what sent prices high. And with the collapse of the global economy, the demand for oil has plummeted, and that brings prices down. And so long as demand is as low as it is today, prices will remain low. And that's combined, of course, with the fact that the global oil supply is much larger than we currently need. The producers of oil, Saudi Arabia, Russia, we were talking about that earlier, have more oil than they can sell. And in a condition of excessive supply and insufficient demand, prices drop.
One of your provisional observations on oil's fate is the price of oil will remain low until it begins to rise again. And do you expect the price of oil to rise soon? What's your prediction for 2009 and beyond?
Yes, and of course, when I made that prediction that it'll stay low until it rises again, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, mm-hmm. because, we know it's low and it's going to stay low for a while and then it's going to rise someday, and obviously nobody could predict when that will be. But it'll rise again when demand creeps up and the current oversupply evaporates. And those conditions will come to pass some point in the future. I don't see that happening in 2009. It may come to pass in 2010. Probably that would be the earliest. But right now, we see no evidence of a dramatic increase in demand. Now, OPEC is trying to reduce the oversupply of oil by cutting back in production. So that eventually will have an impact, and that might bring prices up again a bit. But I would say for the time being, prices will remain relatively low, you know, in the $40, $50 a barrel range. That would be my guesstimate.
And your second provisional observation states that when prices do rise again, they will rise sharply.
Yes. And the reason for that is the following. I alluded to earlier to the point of view that the global supply of oil, looking to the long term, is shrinking. Now, people have been talking about this for a while. Some of your listeners may have heard the expression peak oil, meaning that we're at the point now in the history of oil where the global supply is pretty much at its maximum capacity, and we're facing the time when the global supply of oil will begin to diminish. I believe that is the case, that we're looking at the downslide of world oil production capacity. Now, with the current economic crisis, that projection will be postponed for a while because we're not pumping as much oil out of the ground as we were just 5 or 6 months ago. So when the demand rises again, the oil companies will try to extract what's left. However, in the meantime, they're not doing anything to increase their ability to extract this remaining supply of oil, which will be much more costly and difficult to produce. All the easy oil is now gone. All of the big reservoirs that are close to the surface, that are in inshore locations, it's now been depleted. We've used it. All of the oil that remains in this downside of oil's history is of the tough oil variety. It is far offshore in very complicated wells, deep underground, in small pockets, where it's very complicated to produce, like Canadian tar sands, and it only becomes profitable to produce this tough oil when oil prices are $70, $80, $90 a barrel or more. And what's happened is the oil companies have ceased their investments in these costly projects. So when demand starts to rise again, whether that's in late 2009 or 2010 or whenever it occurs, there will be less oil available on the market than there might have been otherwise. And so there'll be increased demand, but a suddenly inadequate supply of oil to meet that demand, and prices will shoot up.
So all the easy oil reservoirs have been essentially exhausted, and now we're in the era of tough oil. Are energy companies shifting their focus towards research and development of alternative energy sources at this point?
Some of them are, and some of them aren't. And that reflects the political economic culture of the different oil companies. Some, like BP and Shell, which we should point out are European-based companies, where there's greater emphasis on developing energy alternatives, are putting more emphasis into developing energy alternatives, especially advanced biofuels. The American companies, especially ExxonMobil and Chevron, despite all their advertising, are really trying to stick to the development of these tough oil reserves as much as they possibly can. But as I say, they're postponing investment in these new fields. And what they're doing is they're pumping as much oil as they possibly can out of their existing reserves, so they're using up what they have more rapidly than they would have otherwise, and so they're postponing the crisis of oil for more years, you know, further into the future.
You state that petroleum will remain the number one source of energy for at least the next several decades. And whether the price of oil is high or low, it will continue to have a profound impact on our world. And that basically takes us to your third provisional observation on oil's fate. Low oil prices, like high ones, will have a significant worldwide political implication. How is this playing out right now in oil-producing nations, Iran, Iraq, Mexico, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and so on?
Well, the biggest news for the past few days has been the crisis over natural gas supplies. Now, natural gas obviously is in oil, but the price of natural gas is pegged to the price of oil in much of the world. And Russia, the world's second biggest oil producer, has suffered dramatically because of the decline in the price of oil. Russia's economy is heavily dependent on oil and natural gas exports, and their economy has suffered perhaps more than any other oil producing and gas producing country. They've had to cut way back on state expenditures. Most of their government income comes from oil and gas exports. So their state budget is in crisis. Their government budget is balanced only when oil is $70 a barrel or greater. So they're now in deficit territory. They're having trouble keeping the ruble afloat. Companies are going bankrupt. So they're in desperate need for cash. And one of their biggest creditors is Ukraine, which hasn't been paying for their natural gas bills. So on Monday, they cut off the flow of natural gas to Ukraine to try to force them to pay their bills. And that led to a natural gas crisis throughout Europe. It created panic in many parts of Europe. They didn't have enough natural gas to provide heating in Bulgaria and Romania and places like that. And this led to a crisis in the European Union. It looks like it might be resolved, but this shows how these oil pricing effects ripple throughout the world. That's one example, and there are others that we could talk about. Mm-hmm.
So this is an example of Russia in a way demonstrating its political clout due to its energy resources and the fact that, as you said, that, you know, if oil is not at $70 a barrel, they're not making money. And that has immense rippling effects throughout all of Europe because of the great percentage of natural gas that's supplied to Europe through Russia.
Right. This is one example. The fact is that the oil-producing countries, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Iran, Kuwait, and so on, they get most of their government expenditures from the export of oil. And almost all of them have made their budgets on the expectation that oil would be $70 or $80 a barrel this year. So when the price of oil plummets, as it has, their income also drops. So they can't finance all of the health and education programs, social welfare programs that they need to keep their government afloat and to appease their citizens. And many of these countries have high unemployment, have all kinds of social and economic problems, like Iran is an example. Of course, Iran is in a confrontation with the United States about its nuclear programs, but it also has deep internal economic problems, very high youth unemployment, and the government of President Ahmadinejad has come under attack from its own population. And just at this moment, with the price of oil dropping, President Ahmadinejad has announced that subsidies on gasoline are going to be abolished. So the price of gasoline, which is now 36 cents a gallon, picture that, in Iran, is expected to rise to, I don't know, $2 a gallon is what it's coming to here. This very likely could lead to massive protests and riots in Iran in the not-too-distant future. So this would put his government at risk at a time when he's facing a confrontation with the Obama administration. So this shows how the price of oil affects the producing countries politically and affects their international relations.
Indeed, in your book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, you warn that growing demand and competition among the major energy-consuming powers for shrinking supplies of oil might lead to violent conflict down the road.
Well, it certainly leads to violent conflict within countries. An example of that is Nigeria, where the principal source of national revenues from exports is from oil. And it's estimated that the government of Nigeria has accumulated $200 billion over the past 30 or so years from oil exports. But all of this money has come to the central government in Abuja, the capital. No oil is produced in Abuja. It's all produced in the south, in the Niger Delta region on the Gulf of Guinea. And virtually no money has ever trickled down to the poor people who live in that area, which has been environmentally devastated by the production of oil. The rivers have been, it's a river area where the Niger River empties out into a delta-like area, and the rivers have been polluted, the land has been polluted, the fishing industry has been destroyed, crop production has been devastated. People live on less than a dollar a day. Unemployment is 50% or higher. No money has ever made its way down there, and there's a rebellion underway, an armed insurgency underway, and the government is trying to crush that through military force. The government forces are armed and trained by the United States, so the U.S. is militarily connected to this war underway in the region. So conflict is very much driven by oil and the production of oil, but these are internal wars. Another example in which American forces are at risk of being caught in the middle is in Iraq, where the Kurds in the north want to create their own state in order to produce oil and benefit from the production of oil, even at the risk of the breakup of Iraq. And there's a very real risk that as Iraq moves to greater autonomy, as American forces begin to depart, that there'll be a civil war within Iraq over the control of oil revenues, with the Kurds on one side, the Shiites on another, and the Sunnis in the middle.
Now, your recent Newsweek article titled "Time to Kill the Oil Beast, America's Over-Reliance on Petroleum is the Source of All of Its Energy Problems," you describe a grand objective whereby the United States significantly reduces its reliance on oil. Achieving that grand objective would require, it seems to me, strong leadership from President-elect Obama, cooperation from Congress, and sacrifices by the American people, which seems like a tough row to hoe. What problems exist right now because of our over-reliance on petroleum?
I think that we've seen already the consequences of our over-reliance on petroleum. I mean, the whole economic crisis we're in today is partly due to our over-reliance on cheap petroleum, because it was the extension of suburban sprawl to the outer exurbs, financed by cheap and irresponsible mortgage lending, that was the trigger for the economic crisis we're in today. I mean, there were many components to that crisis, irresponsible lending and these corrupt mortgage practices obviously were a big part of it, but a very large proportion of the failed housing schemes were in areas far removed from center city, far from public transit, and were practical only in an era of cheap and abundant oil. And those days are now over. So when well, in this current crisis, and as we recover from the current crisis, I don't see how it'll ever be possible to go back to those spendthrift policies, those irresponsible policies of people commuting 50, 60 miles a day in each direction. And a lot of those outer suburbs, I suspect, will have to be abandoned in the long run. So you already see this, you know, this is not a, this is not something that policymakers could fix. This is a product of an era of cheap petroleum that's gone for good. We have to now think in terms of an era in which petroleum will be increasingly expensive and scarce. And so the grand scheme that I call for, which is to gradually reduce the proportion of our energy that's derived from petroleum, is a matter of necessity. It's not only a matter of choice of something that we want to do because it's desirable. It's a matter of necessity, and finding a way to do that in a practical and an affordable way is something that we must do in any case.
And what would you recommend to President-elect Obama to implement some of the changes that are required to decouple ourselves from this oil economy?
Okay, well, some of the things he has to do are on his plate already because, as I say, of these obsolete notions. I said that the two things that drove us to this condition were cheap and abundant oil and the internal combustion engine. And we have already seen the consequence in this and the collapse of the American automobile industry. Everybody knows that you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and it's very clear that in the efforts to bail out Detroit, they're going to have to reinvent the American automobile industry in a new way, in producing automobiles that are either fuel efficient or run on something other than petroleum. So that's something where I think he's already made clear, policymakers have made very clear, that we have to invent a new mode of personal transportation, and that Detroit has to be rebuilt on that basis. So that's one way we'll do that. That's going to happen in any case. That's clear. Another way is in the economic stimulus package he's putting together. And this has to be fought out in Congress. The notion of building more highways to lead to more suburban sprawl, if that's the way we go, this is suicidal. If it leads in the direction of creating more exurbs that are self-defeating, that would be a mistake in my mind. The bulk of the money should go to public transit systems that conserve energy and that lead to more efficient energy uses in the future. Now, that's an area where there has to be, you know, a struggle in Congress over the wise use of that stimulus package. But building more highways to suburbs that are unsustainable is a mistake.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about peak oil, but it's really not just peak oil, is it? It's peak natural gas, it's peak copper, peak coal, peak uranium, and peak everything, it seems. Is the world running out of resources?
The world is running out of some resources very quickly. Others are more plentiful. So yes, we are running out of many things. We're running out of oil quickly. Natural gas is second in line. Coal is more plentiful than the other two, but of course, if we use coal the way we use now, we condemn the entire planet to becoming uninhabitable to humans anyway. So we can't rely on coal the way we do now anyway. Some minerals like copper are becoming increasingly scarce. Cobalt, nickel. Iron ore is a little bit more widespread, but we can't go on using it forever. Basically, we are depleting the oceans of large, free-swimming fish. Many species of trees have disappeared. Through our rapacious consumption of resources, we are emptying the planet of many of the things that our forebears found when they, you know, first roamed the planet.
And what can local governments and citizens do right now to address the coming resource crisis? And what role does conservation play?
You know, unfortunately, economic forces beyond our control are having the biggest effect right now. When people stop spending, that has the greatest effect on resources. Right now, Americans are cutting way back on their consumption, and this is leading to a slowing of resource consumption. And, you know, I wish it weren't through this kind of painful economic deprivation that we've led to that. I wish it were through more sensible policies that we got to this point, but that's a fact. You know, then government policy can play a role. Now, you're in Portland, Oregon, a city that I admire for its sensible land use policies and transportation policies. That's another way that government could help. Suburban sprawl is one of the most destructive ways of using the planet that we have, because it requires so much energy for transportation, and it uses up so much of the landscape. So the more that you can use zoning to confine development to clustered housing and development around public transportation, that is the wisest policies that you could adopt. And Portland, of course, is a leader in that. And I salute all of you in your beautiful city for adopting those wise policies. I wish the rest of America were so visionary.
Michael Clare, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Okay, thanks a lot, Michael. That was great. Thanks for your time.
All right.
Okay.
That's what you wanted.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All righty.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Try your call again. If you need assistance, dial your operator. Please hang up now. This is a recording. Please hang up and try your call again. If you need assistance, dial your operator. Please hang up now. This is a recording.